we're listening to music of Jared Impichichaha Tate. He's a composer, and he is going to be playing this Thursday night, the 22nd of March, in a concert called Native American Inspirations New Mexico Composers at the Scottish Rite Center, sponsored by the Georgia O'Keeffe Museum. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Chinchukmuk.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Tell us the word you just said.
Chinchukma just means hello in Chickasaw.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. So you're a Chickasaw Indian from Oklahoma, mm-hmm. and you are a classical composer in the Western classical tradition. You are doing music that combines classical with native forms.
Absolutely, yes. And just to clarify my background, my father is Chickasaw Indian from Oklahoma, and my mother is Manx Irish, and she was born in Nebraska.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. So How does that work? How do you bring those traditions together? Did you grow up listening to both kinds of music, participating
yes.
in both kinds of music?
Yeah, absolutely. And actually, it was on my father's side where the classical training comes from. My father is a classically trained pianist and vocalist, and my mother was a choreographer and dancer, and they actually met in the theater. So I have a lot of theater background in my life as well. But the way it kind of works is actually something that the art world can identify with very, very easily, and that is modern art from anybody generally takes icons from their cultural experience or their national origin, and they abstract those icons, and that's been going on for centuries in fine art, of course. And American Indian painters have been doing that. Something that most Americans are actually quite familiar with is to see abstracted icons in their artwork. So you'll see common themes like horses or arrows or buffalo or certain nature scenes or whatever it is geographically where that person comes from. And they'll take those kinds of things and abstract them to certain degrees or another depending on the artist. And so that's what I do as a composer. And to kind of expound on that even more, that's something that we're all actually, again, very familiar with in composition. We identify composers with their national origin. So we know the French composers who composed during like the Impressionistic era, like Debussy and Ravel. We know the Russian composers. We know the Italian composers. There's like Toru Takemitsu, who's a Japanese composer. And all of these people bring in their national identity into the fine art of classical music and create a sound that's very unique to them. So that's what I do very deliberately as a Chickasaw composer.
One of the things I was thinking about as I was contemplating the particular hybrid that you do, if you can call it hybrid, I don't know if that's exactly the right word, but is there are such different musical traditions. I mean, the Western tradition is so much about sitting in an audience and listening to virtuosos go at it, mm-hmm. whereas the native traditions, it seems to me they're so much more associated with ceremony and participation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. And that is something that's very unique about Western art, is it's very staged. I mean, one exception in the Americas is the Northwest Coast, where actually theater performance is actually quite common, where it is staged. So that's actually an example within American Indians that's very similar. However, Western art has made a very specific stamp on the world with that very focused, staged presence or presentation of all the genres of art. I mean, even when you're reading, it's very focused. You know, when you sit in a movie, it's very focused. When you look at a piece of art, you stand very focused. And when you listen to music, it's very focused. So you're absolutely right. And it's something very, very unique that the Western culture has brought to the world.
And so when you bring the native voice, so to speak, the Indian voice, mm-hmm. into that, does it, in your listeners, kind of open up that sense of being in a very staged and also very separated environment where the composer or the performers and the audience are very separate?
Right. You know, honestly, what I do is I actually embrace the Western impetus to create that performance environment. In some ways it's different, in some ways it's not. It's just a different kind of focus. So like, for instance, in traditional Chickasaw stomp dancing, people that aren't actually within the circle of dancers will actually sit like their audience members watching. There's more socializing going on, like people will talk, that kind of thing, and the event can go on all evening, like all night from sundown to sun up. But still, there's still a focus to what's going on inside that circle of people. So I don't think that the Western stamp of fine art performance is counterintuitive necessarily to an Indian experience. It's just got a little more definition in that regard, if that makes any sense.
So what instruments did you grow up playing?
Well, I'm a pianist, and I actually went to school as a piano performance major, and I didn't start composing until I was in graduate school, actually just completing my piano performance degree, and then I actually added composition to it. So, but I was a pianist, and then I also played trumpet.
And so when you were playing piano and you were playing trumpet, were you playing pretty much strictly Western music?
Absolutely, and that was something that I never mixed when I was a kid. I mean, I had my Indian experience and my classical experience, and they were just all very, very separate experiences, and so it wasn't until I started composing that that all came together and just helped me kind of solidify what my path was going to be.
I heard a great story about Astor Piazzolla, who had gone to Paris to study, and then his teacher said, there's something missing here, go back to your roots. He brings in the bandoneon, and everything opens up.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, Piazzolla is a real... that dude is amazing.
I mean,
talk about bringing in your national identity. And I, you know, I have to say it like this. The way he brought it in was with a very specific discipline that was very Western produced, if that makes sense. There is a discipline to fine art that's very specific to fine art. And so what he did is he was doing that. I believe he studied with Nadia Boulanger,
yeah,
is that right?
Yeah.
And so when he brought that to her, he was doing the discipline part very, very well, and she was the one that said, hey, this is great. You've got your technique down. Now bring your personal identity into that. And so it just kind of opened up the floodgate. And I feel like I had a very similar experience when I was commissioned to do a composition based on Indian stories. So it just all just kind of opened up, and that's the path I've been on, you know, since.
So what was that like? I mean, tell us about that initial experience when the floodgates opened, so to speak.
Well, it was scary at first. And the one thing that's really dear to me is that my first commission actually came from my mother. But she trusted me because, you know, I grew up in all her productions, and I grew up in the theater, and so I was extremely familiar with what ballet needs dramatically and everything. So, but when she asked me, I said no. I said, Mom, I think you're crazy to ask me to write this music. I'm a pianist, not a composer. But dancers and choreographers don't necessarily separate their performance from choreography as much as musicians do these days. And so she was like, well, I thought it'd be no problem for you. So anyway, but when I was practicing during that following week, I just started having these ideas come in, and it really just sucked me in. It was like a mudslide, basically. So I wrote some music, and I brought it to her, and I was like, this is what I'm thinking. And so she gave me a thumbs up, and we just went for that.
Should we hear a little clip from that piece?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, this is a clip. This scene is called The Medicine Wheel, and it's from the ballet called Winter Moons.
And that was a little clip from Medicine Wheel, which is ballet music by Jared Impichachaha Tate, who is playing a concert tomorrow night at the Scottish Rite Center. Now, obviously you saw this, you saw your music performed in this ballet and the choreography by your mother.
Right.
What was the ballet like?
Well, the ballet was, it was really cool. It was a ballet based on American Indian stories from the Northern Plains and Rockies, and my mother was teaching in Wyoming at the time, and so she wanted something that related to that area. So it was a really good experience for me. Um, the the difference between that and what I do now is that after that ballet, I immediately went right into Chickasaw music and started working that out, and that's where I've found most of my my achievement in my voice, obviously. But Winter Moons was a good experience because I actually spent time in Wyoming, and so Medicine Wheel, for instance, it's about one of the medicine wheels that's up in the Bighorn Mountains of Wyoming, and so I had this kind of like dramatic aerial view kind of feeling of that, and so it was just a way for me to start cutting my teeth on what I was looking for in expressing a native sound. But what I did not do in that ballet, which I think is really important, is I didn't just lift tunes from the different tribes, because I'm not from those tribes. I went for the sound and the vibe, and then that was the music that occurred. But then once I started diving into working with Chickasaw music, that's when I would transcribe tunes and actually use transcriptions in my music, very much like Béla Bartók did.
Now, you started also working with different instruments. What were some of the instruments that you brought into your compositions?
What I'll do is I'll use kind of native percussion. And that gives me the flavors that I need to. Honestly, the orchestra is just like paint. The orchestra has so much color and so much ability to create illusion sounds to original instruments. So, for instance, one thing that I like to do a lot is in creating an old flute sound is I use piccolo combined with either oboe or bassoon or like alto flute, that kind of thing, because throughout American Indians, our old flutes were actually cane flutes, and it wasn't until recently we started creating these really super advanced like cedar flutes that we have now with extremely smooth sound and very in tune, but cane flutes was the sound of Indian America, and so the piccolo creates that cane flute type of a sound, and I use that with different orchestrations, and so it's again, it's like an illusion like a painter does to an icon. So that's an example. Percussion, of course, you know, the percussion world has so much to it as well that I can colorize things, and so the orchestra is just an amazing palette. It's wonderful.
So you're basically working with a Western orchestra.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, it's just like an Indian painter. Indian painters use acrylics and canvas and paintbrushes, everything that is non-Aboriginal to this country, to express visually what they feel about themselves as Indians. So I'm doing the exact same thing on a musical level, using all of these materials from Western Europe.
One thing I was wondering about also is there's such a different sense of time, linear versus cyclical time in different cultures. And, I mean, time is the essence of music, and I wondered whether going to native roots in your music, whether there was a changed sense of how you thought about musical time.
Well, you know, I would say it's a real hybrid of circumstances. I can tell you that I think the best way to describe that is this. As a Chickasaw Indian, I actually have a very romantic feeling about who I am and what my past is and who we are as a people. And American Indians in general, I have a very passionate and dramatic feeling about it, about our history and you know, who we are as a people. And that just directly relates to theater in my mind. And to me, theater opens up time in a way where you go into somebody's imagination, like it's like a fairy tale land, so to speak. And you just go into a different dimension, and it's a total storytelling of emotions and events and that kind of thing. And so theater, to me, works so well with how I feel about my own people and my own past and present as well. So I just, like I said, I have very dramatic, romantic feelings about being Indian, and so that matches up with theater well. And I say that because my pieces are very theatric in how I write them and how I deliver them. So it just works really well for me to think in both of those terms at the same time.
Well, and in theater, you can live a century in an evening.
Exactly. It's wonderful. It really breaks down time when you go into a theatric presentation. Orchestra is similar, but theater really, really opens that whole door up.
Now, is there a tradition of Native American, American Indian classical composition that you're part of?
Well, yes, as a matter of fact. We have a good group of American Indian classical composers coming up today. It's not huge, but we do have a community of composers right now. And then also, this is probably a good segue to start talking about our actual grandfather of American Indian composition, Lewis Ballard.
Whose music is on the program tomorrow
night.
That's right.
Emmanuel's playing his piano works. And, you know, Lewis, he's the man. he's just wonderful, and he's the one that started all of this. And of course, he was composing back in the 50s and 60s before I was even born. And so, and he has a wonderful history. He's Quapaw Cherokee from Oklahoma. Went to school in Oklahoma, and then he came out to the Institute of American Indian Arts and began like the first American Indian music program. And so here was an Indian guy directing an Indian chorus full of all the students. And what he did was he would make arrangements of traditional tunes for the choir, and they did formal presentations of traditional tunes. So this is another example in which we're kind of sharpening the focus of that. He did the exact same thing, and his pieces were actually quite traditional. You've got to hear his arrangements to appreciate what he did, because he was just starting to lift them out of a traditional presentation into more of a theatric presentation. It was just wonderful. It's, for me, it's really inspiring to hear what he did, because it was so simple yet so powerful. Really concise and very, very intelligent as far as I'm concerned. I'd like to divert on that as well, because there's this is something that the audience, I think, will like to know. This is obviously the centennial of New Mexico, and so as part of the archiving that's been going on, the recordings of Dr. Ballard's chorus have been put online recently. So those were old LPs and reel-to-reels that have been preserved and digitally preserved, and now they're online, and so anybody can actually go and listen to the MP3s online of his original works with the choir.
Very nice.
I had never heard those until 2 months ago. And so, I mean, I remember calling my dad. I was listening to them online. I was almost in tears just listening to the history of Lewis Ballard and his work, and it was so beautiful. And these were a lot of kids from different tribes that were coming together singing traditional music. And he pulled a lot of traditional music from this area when he did that. And so that's why it makes it so special to New Mexico. But I called my dad. I was like, Dad, you've got to get online and check this stuff out, because it was just very emotional to hear what he was doing and to know that all those people are, you know, as I don't know how old they are now, but they were all just kids back then. And there's one recording that he did where he has in the background them singing this Laguna song that's really beautiful, and then all the kids are introducing themselves by name. And it was just wonderful. It was like he was totally historically aware of what he was doing, and so he preserved them on recording doing that.
Now, you are doing a piece, well, the piece that by you that's being played is called Dream World, and it's a tribute to Jean Quixtecy Smith, whose work is being exhibited at the Georgia O'Keeffe Museum, hence the concert sponsored by the O'Keeffe Museum. Tell us about this piece and being inspired by a painter.
Mm-hmm. Well, this piece has a real special place in my heart because, first of all, it was commissioned by the New Jersey Chamber Music Society, and it was being commissioned because they were showing an exhibit of Jean's works out at the Jersey City Museum in 1997. So they were seeking a native composer to write a new piece that was going to be played within that exhibit with a chamber music group. And there were also other American Indian composers on there. There was Lewis Ballard, David Yeagley, and Brent Michael Davids. And so I wrote a new piece, and I asked if I could contact Joan and just talk to her and get to know her art. And had one of the most beautiful phone conversations I ever had in my entire life, and also extremely impactful on what I was doing as a native composer. And so we just had this wonderful conversation, and she said, and I had asked her, can you send me some paintings so I can look at them and draw inspiration and get the whole vibe of what you do? And she said, absolutely. So she sent them out, and so I got them, and of course, I was just absolutely blown away by her work, and it was so inspiring. So I called her back, and we were talking about her pieces some more, and she said, okay, Jared, this is what you're going to do. She said, you're going to write a piece that has poetry, and I want you to perform in it. And I said, okay. So I just did. And so it's basically kind of a performance art piece-ish, but very dramatic and very theater-like. And she just kind of, again, opened a door that I wasn't expecting, and I really ran with it. And this piece is very special to me because of that. So specifically what I did was this, is I wanted to make music that sounded like her paintings look. And at that time, at the series that she was doing back then, was she had a lot of like elements, all kind of multimedia elements. Like she would have pieces of the Charcoosta News from Montana, from her tribe, and different words that were kind of pulled out of context or phrases. And so she had kind of like this non-contextual group of things that together made a really interesting statement. So I wanted to do something very similar with the music. So if I was going to use words, I was at a loss. What words am I going to use? So I had her send me transcripts of interviews that she's done, writings she had in school from back in the 70s, that kind of thing. And so I just extracted words that she said and made poetry out of it. So kind of like what she was doing with painting, she'd pull something out of something and put it on the canvas. Sorry. So that's how I started to do that. The second movement of the work is a very overt example of that, where the poetry kind of goes back and forth to different things, and the moods change suddenly and everything. But it's all her words. But also for the third movement, I wanted to kind of expand a little bit, and she was personally a very big fan of Joy Harjo's poetry, who was a Muscogee Creek gal from Oklahoma, and so I was looking through Joy's poetry, and there was a poem in there that really struck me, that I called Desire, and it was just really cool. So I asked Joy if I could use that poem for the third movement. So, but it was still related to Joan, because again, really good friend, and I was just kind of thinking of all the things that related to her. But so she inspired me to do something very different than what I would have normally.
We're talking to composer Jared Impichichaha Tate. Now, did you grow up speaking Chickasaw language?
No, I did not. My grandmother's first language was Chickasaw, but once she started going to Indian boarding school, she stopped speaking the language. And so, unfortunately, there's a big gap in language around Indian country, but the upside is that the Chickasaw Nation is doing an enormous amount of language immersion programs and apprenticeship programs, and I am starting to learn the language slowly as I go. One vehicle that I've used for myself is my compositions, and I've deliberately used the Chickasaw language in my vocal pieces, and that's actually helping me learn my language better. And so what I do is I go to my cousins, relatives, or other friends who speak the language, and I ask them to translate for me. So I usually create the poetry myself or the lyrics, and then I have them translated.
Oh, okay. Now you have a composition where you've got the San Francisco Symphony and Chorus singing in Chickasaw.
That's right. That's right. I'm really proud of this. This CD that we recorded in 2007 was a landmark because it's the first time the Chickasaw language has been put into a classical context like this. So now it's I feel good because I'm putting it in the same level as Italian and German and French. And so, the chorus sang in Chickasaw, and it was really fun because, you know, singers are really, really into languages. They're total language nerds, which is, of course, that's what they do. So we had a really, really good time. They had a good time learning it, and it was fun to coach them on it. We had really good sessions and rehearsals for that.
Why don't we hear a little bit of that? Tell us what we're about to hear. This is actually the San Francisco Chorus?
Yes, that's
Symphony
right.
Chorus.
So this is off a piece entitled Iholba, which means the vision, and... this second movement is also called Iholba, but this is the San Francisco Symphony and the San Francisco Symphony Chorus singing, and this is actually the end, the climax of the entire work.
Okay, let's hear it. Again, that was music by Jared Impichichaha Tate, composer, who is playing in a concert tomorrow night at the Scottish Rite Center here in Santa Fe at 463 Paseo de Peralta. It's sponsored by the Georgia O'Keeffe Museum. And on the program are not only music of Jared Tate, but also Lewis Ballard and Raven Chacon and Peter Garland. And flying in from Italy is a pianist named Emanuele Arciulli, who will be playing some of this music. Or you're familiar with his playing? I guess he plays a lot of Native American compositions.
You know, he's been focusing on that. He's also been coordinating concerts of American Indian composers around the world, actually, which is really, really cool. But for this performance, he's going to be focusing on a lot of Lewis Ballard solo piano music. There's a piece by Raven Chacon that is for piano and electronic reinforcement. And then he's also doing a suite by Peter Garland called Walkin' Beauty. So it's actually it's a very big piano solo recital as well.
Well, it looks to be an amazing evening. I'm looking forward to it myself. Once again, at the Scottish Rite Center. For tickets, you can call 505-946-1039. You can also go to okmuseum.org. Jared Impichichaha Tate, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
I'd like now to welcome to the program Michelle Herling. She is the producer of Minds Interrupted, an evening of monologues, which is happening this Saturday, the 24th of March in Los Alamos. And John Harnish, he's a retired Army officer and educator, and he was a presenter in the first evening of Minds Interrupted. And Ann Albrink, who is a lawyer here in Santa Fe, and she's a performer in the Saturday night event. All three are members of NAMI, which stands for the National Alliance on Mental Illness. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Thank you,
thank you very much.
So, Michelle, Minds Interrupted, what is it? What's the evening all about?
The evening is an evening of six people on stage sharing their heartfelt stories about the impact of mental illness on their lives. And they are either going to be people who have an illness or family members who have a loved one with an illness.
And how did this whole thing come about?
It came about as a result of a program that NAMI Santa Fe puts on called Family to Family. It's an educational program, an incredibly dynamic program for family members who have loved ones with mental illness. And as I took that program, and as a result of it, I came up with this idea of wanting to advocate for people with mental illness. I have a brother with a mental illness, and I wanted to advocate for people with mental illness in a bigger way than just for my brother. And so Minds Interrupted was an idea I conceived of. And the NAMI Santa Fe board took off on it, and Rosemary Zebert came on board as co-creator of it, and we were off and running. We were only going to do it one time in Santa Fe, but then people from other parts of New Mexico reached out to us, because every time we go in, we work with residents of that area.
And so you chose Los Alamos this time as a place where you wanted to work specifically with Los Alamos residents?
Yes. We have someone had invited us to come up and do this program up in Los Alamos, and so we reached out to residents there. We found three family members. It's the first time ever we're putting three family members on stage. It's a very powerful, poignant pulling together of two different perspectives.
Together in one performance, so to speak?
In one performance, yeah. So we have three people from Los Alamos and two people from Santa Fe and one person from Española.
Let's talk to some of the folks who've either presented or are presenting in Minds Interrupted. And I don't know how much you want to talk about your own story, but what was it like for you to decide to join this group and engage in telling your own story, which must be risky to do in some ways?
Well, it is, but now that I'm older, it doesn't matter so much. I don't think I would have done this in my 40s or even my 50s. I saw the first monologues that came on in Santa Fe in 2008, and I was very deeply touched, and I got involved with NAMI. And this is sort of the culmination in, not culmination, I hope, but it's a big step in my involvement in NAMI.
So you, Anne, when you were a young woman, started, as I guess they would say in the medical profession, exhibiting symptoms, but didn't get a diagnosis for a long time.
That's right. I got a tentative diagnosis in my early 20s of, I picked the diagnosis, actually.
Which is weird.
Well, it was weird to me, too. I was in the mental hospital. I'd been there for 5 weeks, and at the end of it, the doctor gave me a choice of three different diagnoses, and the one that sounded the best to me was schizophrenic reaction, so that's the one I picked.
And that turned out not to be accurate or helpful.
Right. I had had some psychosis in my first episode in my early 20s, and that didn't happen again. It wasn't until I actually heard the diagnosis of bipolar that I realized, oh yes, of course that's what I was. I had every single symptom. Well, not every symptom. Thank God my father was careful enough with money that I didn't spend my life away in terms of getting into debt. But other than that, I had all the symptoms of bipolar.
Which was basically what they call manic depressive.
That's correct.
So some moments where you feel on top of the world and you have to sleep for days at a time. And
that's it. And I talked 24 hours a day, and I walked everywhere without looking to the left or right when I crossed the street. And it wasn't for me the great, oh, I'd love to go back to that state again that it is for some people who have manic depression. But it certainly was better than the depression part of the illness. The depression part is to be the pits.
Yeah. Now, you say it's not something you'd like to go back to, but so many people, and I think you talk about this a little bit in your writing, have this tremendous confidence and kind of intellectual and sense of I can do anything. And did you feel that?
Oh yeah, especially when I was in law school, I had an episode, and it comes upon you gradually. So I got more and more confident and more outgoing and more assertive. And eventually I asserted myself into the talking 24 hours a day, not sleeping, et cetera, and so forth. And they carted me away to UNM Medical. So,
did it have any benefits for you, for example, as a student?
I don't know. They say that people with manic depression are unusually imaginative. And I've always been gifted with an ability to be verbally eloquent, and that helped me a lot in law school. I won the entire moot court competition when I competed in law school, and that was because of my verbal ability. So in some ways, things, the good parts of your personality go hand in hand, I think.
When you were in those episodes, did you know there was something wrong?
No, only people kept telling me there was something wrong. And so it was not a surprise to me when I got carted away, but I didn't have any insight about it until I got all the meds and crashed.
We're talking about Minds Interrupted, an evening of monologues, which is happening this Saturday night. Let's turn to John Harnish for a moment. You wrote a monologue a couple of years ago about a family member. Is that right?
Yes, our daughter, our third child, Helen.
And what motivated you to write? What was the situation that you were writing about with your daughter?
Well, like others, when I was approached to participate in this, I went back to my experience with Family to Family, the NAMI program on mental illness, which is for family members of mentally ill people. And it helped us so much, my wife and I, and my older daughter, that I realized this was an opportunity to give back or share some valuable information that might help someone else. Our daughter, Helen, we came to find out after many, many years that she, in fact, didn't have what is commonly referred to as a learning disability, but a developmental disability. And on top of that, she was diagnosed with mental illness.
And what's the difference between learning and developmental disability?
The difference is a total lack of executive functions when someone is developmentally disabled. That is, they have difficult time understanding situations, reading between the lines, insight, foresight, looking back and learning from past mistakes so that they're not repeated in the future, those kinds of things are much more problematic for someone who is developmentally disabled.
What were some of the stresses on you and your wife as parents dealing with a daughter who had these problems?
Well, we basically shepherded her through special education successfully through most of her schooling years. But then as she graduated from high school and began to move out into the world, she developed a variety of symptoms that were unusual, such as extreme anxiety over very normal situations. And so we actually brought her in for a diagnosis, and over the next year or two, she underwent a series of different diagnoses, starting with depression, including anxiety disorder, agoraphobia, and finally even schizophrenia. So this was about the time she was ready to turn 20 years old, and now she's 38 or 37. All those different early diagnoses have settled down into a depression and anxiety disorder. But my talk in the monologues was the journey from when she was even a young, very young child to now, and we're still on the journey, helping her navigate through life. And not only what the challenge was for us, but also what the insights were to have a child with those kinds of disabilities and mental illness, and how that affects everybody in the family, and how we learn from that, even about ourselves.
Say more about that. What are some of the things that you learned about yourselves?
Well, one of the ones that was especially true for me personally was I tend to be a fixer. You know, I like to fix things, to include, a broken fence or a vacuum cleaner that doesn't work. But I also like to be helpful to people who have difficulties in life and be a kind of a strong person for them. And so I've always tried to fix Helen. You know, tried to help her with schoolwork, and then finally tried to help her with the symptoms of the disease, the brain disease, and the things that she suffered because she wasn't on a par with her peers. So the insight was, I can't fix that, and I ought to stop trying and find a different way to relate and to help rather than always thinking I can play God and fix something that is not fixable, really. It's possible to help a person with mental illness cope and recover and learn to live with the disability or the illness. It's not possible to fix it.
Did that transfer into how you related to other people who came to you with problems, that you were less likely to try to fix them too?
Absolutely. It gave me great insight into other people with mental illness or disabilities of any kind.
And when you embarked on the process of writing this monologue that you're going to read on Saturday night, and you went through the whole process and you're working with other people in the monologues and with the director and so on, did you feel like it was a kind of a healing process for you in looking back at your life and the illnesses that you've suffered?
It really was. I think I had put under the rug, so to speak, the painful part of the depressions. I'd always sort of focused on the amusing stories of the stupid things I did when I was in my manic stage. But the months and months of just feeling awful, I had put under the rug, and bringing it back forward in this process was really healing for me. I felt exhausted, but I felt a good exhaustion.
Now, Michelle, let's talk about the bigger picture. I mean, everybody here is part of the National Alliance on Mental Illness, and maybe you can tell us a little bit about the organization, but above all, this question of what people who are listening to this show today, for example, might not know about mental illness, how common it is, and how it affects so many people's lives.
That's really true. The statistics keep changing, and they are now 1 in 4 American families are impacted by mental illness. I just came down from Los Alamos. I've spent a couple of days there talking with teenagers who were having a unit on mental illness and the different disorders. And we were bringing them the stories. One of the presenters from Los Alamos, who is in college, came with me and shared his story, and I talked about the monologues. And they were really amazed to find out that that the impact of these illnesses is so prevalent amongst teenagers, amongst adults.
I wonder how much of that prevalence and perhaps the increase in numbers has to do with post-traumatic stress. Do you have any sense of that?
I really don't. Of course, post-traumatic stress disorder has really come to the foreground because of our soldiers, our armed forces in Afghanistan and Iraq, and reaching back into Vietnam. But I don't have numbers and statistics.
And it's so much an experience of women who are continually being assaulted and victims of domestic violence and rape and bullying and all these kinds of things, too.
Yes, absolutely.
About 1 in 4 families are affected by a severely mentally ill person. And the mental illness is something which has not ever been treated like diabetes or high blood pressure or cancer. And I think we're hoping that the monologues are going to put us away from the stigma that we've suffered and put us back into the fact that this is a biology-based illness. This is not something that our mothers did to us.
Except when it is.
Well, mothers can hurt, but mothers can also help.
I guess I just mean that some illnesses are biologically based. Some are caused by trauma. I mean, these people who come back from war or whatever, they're just not the same people as they were before. But then, as you say, if it were to be treated like diabetes or some other illness, how would that be different for you in your life?
Well, I think all of us are born with certain vulnerabilities in our environment, our families, and our experiences as we grow up affect these vulnerabilities in a different way. I know that the research that you see on places like Charlie Rose show that they're finding genes that are associated with schizophrenia, and they are finding analyzing blood and analyzing other chemical things in a person's body help psychiatrists pinpoint treatments that help. And I know with me, when I first started out, they were giving me Thorazine and heavy electric shock treatments and things that made me sort of like a zombie. And now they have all these new medications that really pinpoint your symptoms and help you become yourself more so that you can take care of things.
We're talking about Minds Interrupted, an evening of monologues, this Saturday evening. Now, Michelle Herling, you are the founder of the Compassionate Touch Network. What is that all about?
That's an organization that I founded that promotes community health through education, healing, and the arts. And Minds Interrupted is a major project of the Compassionate Touch Network now. So we are co-producers of the monologues along with NAMI Santa Fe for the Los Alamos monologues.
And you've got people coming from high school. You've got families of folks who were in the monologues. You've got people from the National Alliance on Mental Illness. And we hope just regular people who might be listening to this show or who've just heard about it.
Yes, absolutely. Everyone is invited. The reason we do these stories on stage is because we want to invite the public to come and hear these stories. We know that if you do not have a family member or yourself do not have a mental illness, that you probably know someone, either as a teacher or you might have a friend who has a mental illness. Andrew, who I've been working with these last couple of days in the high school, has said that it was his college roommate that called his his parents and said, something is awfully wrong with your son. You need to get out here. And they went out immediately and began to help him find his path back from his illness.
I think there's another part of this that I always think about when I hear these stories, which is that many of these stories, for example, manic depression, are really extreme versions of what so many quote-unquote normal people go through in much more mild ways in their lives. Everybody experiences, many people experience depression, and there is a kind of relating that we can do from our own experience, even if our own experience isn't that extreme. I don't know if you guys feel that way.
Well, I would say that there's some truth in that. On the other hand, someone who has a serious clinical mental illness often experiences what we term a psychotic break, where they actually are kind of out of their mind and imagining things to be there that are not there, or things that are there, they're imagining them to be something different. And they hear voices, and they respond to stimuli that are in their brain, but are not, in fact, real. But they cannot tell that those stimuli are not real. And so that really separates them from a person who does not have a diagnosed mental illness. And it is just very sad, but not necessarily clinically depressed, or someone who is very euphoric, but not exactly manic. There is a difference, a huge difference.
I think the diagnoses really are an art. I mean, the science part of this is just being worked on all the time, and it's difficult. Most of these stories have people starting out with one diagnosis and ending with another.
And these diagnoses are, to some extent, I mean, there's a sense of arbitrariness when you look at how the DSM manuals are compiled, which is 12 guys in a room making decisions about what the new version is going to say. It's very tricky business.
But it's getting better. And as Anne said, technology, which has advanced so much in the last 20 years, 30 years, to study the brain and find out what those chemical imbalances exactly are and what's going on with the transmission of electrical signals and where they break down is leading to medications that are constantly evolving and more pertinent to what's actually going on in the brain.
And I know a lot of friends of mine who have mental illnesses are experiment for a long periods of time with different cocktails of medications with their psychiatrists until they reach the place that is best for them. And it is an art, as Michelle was saying. It's not, in that way, it's not a science yet. You don't just put in your blood and come out with what your medication should be.
And even after the trial and error period, the body and the mind can get used to certain medications and become less responsive. And at that time, the medication often has to be changed in order to have the same results.
The evening is Minds Interrupted, an evening of monologues. Michelle Herling is the producer. She's also the founder of the Compassionate Touch Network. And John Harnish is a retired Army officer and educator. He was in the first Minds Interrupted. Anne Albrink is a Santa Fe lawyer. She's a performer in the Saturday evening event. It's Saturday, the 24th of March at 7 o'clock at the Duane Smith Auditorium in Los Alamos at 1300 Diamond Drive. For more information, you can go to mindsinterrupted.com. You can also go to namisantafe.org. NAMI is N-A-M-I. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Oh, thank you, Mary Charlotte.
Thank you.
It's been a pleasure.